Welcome to the AquariumX audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 172A, part one of the interview with Jim Carmark. Before we begin, I'm just going to give you a little info on Jim. He's been keeping fish since he was five. He majored in chemistry with a biology minor and started Scituate Cichlids in 1969, 2 years after joining the newly founded American Cichlid Association. In 1978, he started Oceans Unlimited, where he worked mostly with large, fresh, and saltwater systems and custom filters. And then in 1987, he took his first collecting trip to South America, has since made over 40 trips to Central and South America, including Peru, Venezuela, Brazil, Ecuador, Belize, Panama, Honduras, and all over the Caribbean. In 1995, he switched from selling mainly African cichlids to South American fish. He has bred almost 500 species of fish, most of them cichlids, but he's also bred cardinal, tetras, neon tetras, splash tetras, gold tiger plecos, and others, including the first documented spawning of Cynodontis multipunctatus in 1976. He has three kids, is married to a fellow fish nut, and they currently run about 85 tanks, totaling about 2,000 gallons. They breed angelfish. The varieties that they work with are red koi, platinum, blue pearl, red top pandas, wild cross, manakupuru, double dark blacks, and black lakes crosses. They also work with pistogrammas, discus, stingrays, swordtails, guppies, and plecos. He buys and sells fish on a regular basis at swap meets, club events, and on the internet. He's been a member of the Boston Aquarium Society since 1966. He currently runs a company specializing in green development work, including solar installations, ponds, gray water recycling, etc. So there's a little introduction to Jim. Now we're going to delve into the mysteries of epistogrammas and beyond.
So here we are with Jim Carmark. Am I saying that name right?
That's correct.
Okay. We're very excited to have him on the show today, and we're going to talk about epistos, as we mentioned. So we usually like to get started with a few general questions to welcome you to the show. So here we go. Here's the first question.
Tell us some about how you got your start in the aquarium hobby.
I started keeping fish when I was 5 or 6 years old with the goldfish and the turtle and the little plastic bowl and all that. But before too long, I started keeping guppies, and by the time I was probably 10 years old, they had 7 or 8 fish tanks going, mostly 10-gallon tanks. And I used to raise water plants and sell them to local pet stores, along with fancy guppies. But I always got more for the plants than I did for the guppies.
That's very fun.
Yeah, that's actually pretty similar to how I got into the hobby. Something very much like that. So I know you have a wide variety of experience in the hobby, and you've run companies and so on that center around fish. But what are some of your main interests currently as far as the aquarium hobby goes?
Well, I've always liked South American fish, especially angelfish and discus. So my wife and I now have a fish room that's a large proportion of it is exotic angelfish varieties, you know, like platinums, the new platinums, and the pinatubo blues, and the double dark blacks, and things like that, along with discus, and we're going now into trying to breed the stingrays.
Which species of stingrays are you looking into?
We've got 4 matoros now of 3 different types. We've got 2 males, 2 male matoros. One's a super spot, and one's a black, and we've got 2 female matoros. One is a marble matoro, and one's a regular matoro.
Wow.
That's really cool.
Yep. And they're all hand.
Your biographical information before talking about it. Kelly was really excited about the stingrays, and she looked at me and said,
"I love stingrays.
Can we have stingrays someday?"
look on our Facebook page, Oceans Unlimited, and it's got pictures of our stingrays and discus and plecos.
We can put the link on our on the show page too,
mm-hmm.
so listeners
mm-hmm.
can check it out.
We're also breeding some exotic plecos here. I've got LDA01 gold tiger plecos spawning. We've got Rio Atabapos have been on eggs a couple times. We've got vampires that we're trying to breed, L240s. I get a lot in gold, green phantoms. We have a colony of those set up. L75 gold leopards. A lot of the plecos and stingrays are going to be, they're being over-collected in many localities, and they're going to be going on a lot of prohibited lists in the near future, I feel, especially stingrays. You know, there's no way a animal that only has 2 to 8 pups can be harvested hard. You know, it's not like a cardinal that's got 1,000 babies in a season.
Right.
So the future of those in the hobby is really in captive breeding.
Well, wild fish are a really important component of the hobby. You know, so it's vital that we keep wild stock available as a resource to us.
We don't
even know what we don't know yet. You know, like Agassiz, we used to think, talking about Epistogrammas, we used to think Epistogramma Agassiz occurred from Peru all the way down to Belém at the mouth of the Amazon. And now we know it's probably 12 or 13, 14, maybe 20 species. You know, it's every creek seems to have a different Agassiz on the way down. And you do the DNA work on them, and they're related, but they're not closely related.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
there's a lot of fish. There's a waterfall-dwelling piranha. This is really interesting, that we studied in Brazil. 3 piranhas, no more than 20 kilometers apart. They all look identical. They only occur under waterfalls. They look exactly the same. They're all the same species, obviously. And yet the DNA, there was more divergence in the DNA between the 2 farthest piranhas that were 40 kilometers apart than there is between all the trophies in Lake Tanganyika.
Wow.
Yeah. We don't even know what that tells. We don't even know what that's saying. You know, how can 3 fish that are so genetically different look exactly the same and live in exactly the same habitat? And how can fish that are so genetically close look so totally different?
Right.
You know, we don't, and behave different. And, tropius, they're all over the place. Well, do you want to talk about some epistogrammas? I've been in South America a number of times. I've been in Peru 9 or 10 times, and I've been in Brazil probably a dozen times, and along with a couple side trips into Venezuela and Ecuador and Panama, and I've been all over Central America too, but I really love South America. You know, there's nothing finer than wading knee deep in a igarapé in the middle of the jungle catching something new. I've discovered something new. You know, I found 7 new species, but one of my greatest thrills was when the first time I got out of a boat back in 1987 in the middle of the Peruvian jungle, and I dipped into the water and I came up with angelfish. I went, wow, aquarium fish at last.
Yes.
I've been collecting native fishes for years, but, you know, it's not the same catching darters. And, you know, they're really cool and they're beautiful, but when you see something that you've paid money for before in your hand, you go, this is cool. This is
definitely
really cool.
Yeah, that's a whole different experience. That makes sense. But
yep.
You said you found 7 new species of epistogrammas?
No, I've discovered 7 new species. Not of epistas. Only one was an episto.
Oh, okay.
One was a fish. One was a buhukina, mouth-fooding buhukina species. One was a pyrolina species. One was a colpina species. We discovered that if you draw a circle 1 day's or 1.5 days' travel out from a major city like Iquitos, 95% of the discovered species are in that circle, that one-day travel. And if you draw 2 days' travel, it's like 99% of the species. Only if you go 3-4 days out, which we would take a riverboat, hire a riverboat, and go 4 or 5 days up these rivers, up the Napo or the Mamone, or these fairly decent-sized rivers, but that aren't real big, but decent-sized, and go way, way, way up them, and we'd find all new fish. We'd find plecos we'd never seen before. We'd find epistos we'd never seen before. We found all kinds of stuff. So, of course, we try to shoehorn them into what we thought they were, because, you know, there's only, if you look at the list of of Epistogrammas in Peru at the time, there were like five species. So we thought we had Juruensis and Agassizii and Vitaniata, and we probably were catching those near Iquitos, but as we went farther out, we were catching other things that looked like them but weren't. There's there's at least three species that have been shipped in as Juruensis, and at least five species that have been shipped in as Coccatoids, which just confuses the hell out of everybody and makes for a lot of misidentification and inbreeding and or outbreeding. Well, the gold cerum is a perfect example. The gold cerum is not a spot of a species. It is a mixture of a number of different species of fish that we used to all call cerum, and now are everything from appendiculatum to cerus to, I mean, there's what, 9 species of cerum now? 10 species of cerum? And festivum is the same way. There's like 9 or 10 species of festivum now, from insignis to zebrinus to notat. I mean, there's a bunch of them. So as we learn more about what how fish are distributed, and we look more carefully at color patterns and, of course, the DNA, we're learning that a lot of these, there's a lot more speciation going on than we ever thought, you know. And it makes sense that fish, it can't be the same fish 1,000 miles apart. You know,
In the old days, I know when they collected angelfish, it's said now that they collected at least 3 different species that are all ancestors of the aquarium angelfish, at least. So they think that all 3 of them probably contributed. And it's sort of the same idea with some of these other cichlids, too.
Yes, coccatoids. You mentioned you wanted to talk about the origin of the Epistogramma coccatoids.
I have a lot of listeners interested in that. That would be great.
We have we caught wild red coccatoids in the Rio Ucayali tributaries. The Rio Ucayali itself is part of the... if you trace the origin of the Amazon up in the Andes and trace it down, it goes to a number of name changes. And it doesn't really become the Amazon until it leaves Peru. It's called the Ucayali which the Peruvians have a name for their portion of the Amazon. But the Ucayali is very, very alkaline because it's basically a lot of Andes mountains washing down into it. We found pHs as high as 8.6. But in the small tributaries, the Blackwater tributaries and the Clearwater tributaries, the pHs were much more moderate, below 7, all of them, and some were as low as 5. We didn't get the really acid waters that you got in Brazil. On the Guyana Shield and the Rio Negro, we were getting pHs down in the 3s. But in Peru, we routinely found pHs of 5, and that's when we found the red coccatoids, which has a big mouth, lots of a relatively big mouth, lots of red in the caudal fin, and some red streaking in the dorsal. Now there was another fish that was discovered farther west in Atahualpa that I saw in the exporters. And it had a much more reddish cast to the tail, and the spotting was different. And the mouth structure was obviously different, but they were still calling it coccatoids. And I know that a guy took imported a batch of the red-spotted coccatoids, and I sold them into a couple of pistol breeders in Connecticut and New Jersey. And the next thing I knew, there was something they were calling the double red coccatoids of pit. And I asked him what he had done, and he said he had taken the wild ones that I had sold him and bred them into an existing strain of coccatoids. Or in those days, we didn't call them coccatoids, we called them Borelli. And he bred them into an existing strain of Borelli. And that's just about the time when the name change was going on. So we changed the name to... coccatoids, and we called them double reds. And then from the double reds, the triple red was selectively bred into it. And that's what you see a lot now. But its hybrid origin is portrayed by the skewed sex ratios. It doesn't really matter what pH you breed them at. Opistos are very pH-dependent and temperature-dependent on sex ratio determination. But with the cockatoids, it doesn't much matter. You still get very, very heavy males. I've seen 100 males to one female in a batch before.
Wow.
And 75 to 80 to 4 or 5 females is routine in a lot of these triple red and double red strains. There are strains now. There is a double red strain now that they've crossed back to some wild stock, and it's not as good a strain as some of them, but it's got an almost 50-50 ratio again. But it's really unfair to give these things a name of cockatoids, because it's no more cockatoids than a swordtail or Xiphophorus helleri. You know, I mean, certainly it's got helleri in it, but it's got a lot of platy in it too, you know. It's got maculatus and variatus and God knows what else has been bred into it. And it's a good fit. I mean, you know, red swordtails are great fish, but they're not true pure swordtail. And we shouldn't pretend they are. And we shouldn't pretend that that gold severum or cockatoids or a lot of these fish are any better. I mean, I have people that stick their noses up at hybrid fish like red parrots and flower horns, but they think nothing of gold severum and cockatoids. And it's exactly the same situation.
They just realize that it's the same situation.
Yeah, I mean, and look at Malawi peacocks. You know, they've hybridized those to the point where God knows what you get now. You know, some of the stuff coming out of Taiwan, it could be anything.
Right.
So, but I did a number of collecting trips, specifically to collect pistos. And one time in Brazil, I brought back almost 3,000 fish.
Wow.
Yeah, we were, and a lot of these were so small, we had no idea what they were.
They were
just collecting,
too young, they hadn't matured yet?
Well, for instance, we collected at river bends, when a creek or a small river takes a sharp bend, what we call biotrash ends up floating on the surface at one of the bends, and it's leaves and sticks and foam and just junk. And if you take a dip net and go into that biotrash, you end up with these little half-inch long brown opistogramma-like cichlids. I say opistogramma-like because we were sure they were opistogramma, but we grew them up in our tanks for a month and we realized they were Tenia caracandidae, which we had been searching in vain for, could not find them anywhere. And we ended up with over 100 of them because we had brought back all these little tiny babies.
They would be
in.
We found some serendipitous biotrash, I guess.
Yep. And other fish like Bioticus opercularis was found on sandy beaches with leaf litter scattered on it. And we would take a fine mesh seine and pull them up. Are you familiar with Bioticus? It's a it's a small perch-like cichlid. Beautiful little animal that is never imported because it's extremely delicate and can't be shipped. The first time they were shipped in, 500 of them were shipped into New York and one survived.
Wow.
The second time, 500 were shipped in, two survived.
Ouch.
So I went down to Brazil with the intent purpose of bringing some back to Moon and Aquarium to breed. So I'm a chemist, and Scott is the senior freshwater aquarist at Moon and Aquarium. So he asked me if I want to come along and see what we could do. So we netted 22 of these specimens. And normally you put them into a bucket and they roll over and die. So I decided to do some experimentation. So we used some fish tranquilizer called Jungle Hypno.
Mm-hmm.
And we knocked them out and kept them in AmQuil in a dark cooler for 9 days. And we had 100% survival. shipped them back to the United States and had 19 out of 22 survive. And they woke up in a, fish tank in Boston and bred 3 weeks later.
Wow. It's a pretty successful experiment.
Yeah. Well, you know, stress is the big killer of the fish. And shipping fish kills a lot of them. And I developed techniques for using baby bottle bags. You know, the little tiny 2 ounce and 4 ounce bags.
Mm-hmm.
And I would take a pistogrammus and I would trank them, so they were just almost completely knocked out. And I would ship them in a teaspoon of water. And I could ship 200, 300 fish. Of course, you get high as a kite from the tranquilizer fumes after you handle it 4 or 5 times. But you know, you could, and my survival rate was 97-98%.
That's amazing.
I mean, you know, it was remarkable. I could, and I did that a lot. We brought a lot of fish back over the years. But the way we getting into the actual collecting, epistogrammas are seldom found in anything resembling a river. Found in very shallow creeks and flooded forests. Especially flooded forest. We were netting. We were in Peru one time in Genaro Herrera, and we were looking for Nisenai. And I think I mentioned it took us 3 trips into the type of Genaro Herrera is the type locality for Nisenai. This is where the Germans had discovered it. We were there the very next year looking for it. We searched in vain for it, and we searched for 5 days, and we could not find a single specimen. We went back the next year, searched again for it, could not find a single specimen. Went back the 3rd year, went back a month earlier, and we found 200 of them.
Wow.
In the same area. They were in flooded forest, but as the forest retreated and they went into the creeks, we could not find them.
So it's the seasonal availability of that area that they breed in, and then as soon as that's gone, they're gone.
Right.
Makes sense.
And, you know, you would think that in flooded forests they'd all be spread out, but there were literally hundreds of them. You know, small, you know, a lot of small specimens. And apparently what we were catching was what was left over from the receding ponds. In Peru especially, you get a lot of these little potholes forming for some reason. And people have given me various explanations for their existence, but you'd be walking through the jungle and you see a hole that's maybe 6 feet across, and it might be 2 feet deep, it might be 4 feet deep, it might be 8 feet deep. And there's fish in it, teeming with fish, always rivulus, and often, almost always a pistogramma, and usually one of the little cryptic catfish like banjo cats or sometimes autosynclus, and they were always cool, 72 to 76 degrees, dark water, no movement at all, it was just a little biotope, and almost never any tetras. You never saw tetras in those biotopes. You only saw tetras in Peru. They occur in grass beds, and they occur by the gazillion. When you see one tetra, you see 2,000 tetras. We saw a boat one time that had caught a school of silver dollars, and they were all exactly the same size, and there were at least 20,000 of them.
Wow.
Yeah. And they caught them in a gill net one night, just on one little river, and the school was going by, and they caught. I mean, the canoe was so full, it was... The canoe was 20 feet long and 3 feet wide, and it was a foot deep in these fish.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well,
and
I can certainly attraction.
They take them and they dry them. They dry them and they eat them. And they do a lot of things with fish down there that we never see. You know, the native culture relies almost exclusively on fish as a source of protein. Very little animal protein goes in there. But anyway, as I started to say, you never see epistos in the rivers. Once in a while, in a creek with a lot of bogwood. I did a lot of snorkeling down there. I'd be fortunate enough to see a female opistil because the bright yellow color stands out on the females. You see a female going in and out of a cave. And if you stay real still and you watch, sometimes I was rewarded with seeing her with 6, 8, 10 fry. But more often, the common method of finding opistils is you take a dip net and you net it through the leaf litter. You're standing in maybe knee-deep water, covered in water lettuce, mosquitoes and spiders everywhere. I'm talking everywhere. You net up you dip the net into the water, you slide along the bottom, pick it up, half full of leaves and water lettuce, and probably 400 or 500 spiders run out of it, run all over your arms. I mean, you know, they're harmless, but it still freaks you out. And then you shake the water lettuce off, and you walk over to shore, and you dump the net upside down and start picking through it. You'll have anywhere from really nothing. But usually you'll have 6 or 8 banjo cats. You'll have a dozen opistogrammas of various sizes. You might have a pleco if you're fortunate, like a Picoltia, or a every so often you get a Hoplias. They are the bane of the opistos' existence. The opistogrammas seem to have an adaptation for low oxygen, and you'll find them in areas where other fish shy away from, especially the big predators. Excuse me, pike cichlids require a lot of oxygen, and you'll see them. You see them a lot in floating meadows. You see grass will grow out onto the water surface, and it will look just like a meadow, except there's water underneath it. It could be 6 inches of water. It could be 6 feet of water. And under the deeper meadows, you'll find a whole unique fish population of pike cichlids and chocolate cichlids and waroo and things like that hanging out there right under those meadows. And when sometimes these things break loose and float down the river with their fauna following them. But the main predator they eat small fish, of course, you know, all those guys. But right. in the real shallow flooded forest, especially when it gets really warm, the oxygen level drops to 1 ppm, 2 ppm at the most, and Hoplias do fine because they can breathe air. So they're in there hunting the opistos. And the opistos, I've seen opistos, we had 0.5 ppm dissolved oxygen, and yet we saw female opistos with young, we observed. And what was really cool, I think I mentioned this to you, one of the common breeding strategies of the female opistogramma is to use a rolled-up reef as a cave.
You did mention that.
A lot of leaves will, when they go into water, they will curl up and they will form a tube, maybe 4 inches long and as big around as your finger, or little finger, not very big, a little bigger than a pencil. And you'll see, you know, when you're sorting through the leaves, in the dip net debris, you'll see these curled up leaves, and we've learned to grab them and dump them into photo tanks. And sometimes we dump them out with lava, and sometimes eggs, and always a very mad female. And you could immediately tell because she'd have the bright yellow coloration. Almost all female opistogrammas, when they are courting or raising young, bright, bright lemon to chromium yellow with various patterns on them. But they're, we had them at the New England Aquarium breeding in the piranha tank, and the piranhas completely ignored them. And, you know, they were, and right now they're breeding in the tank with anacondas.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, they're too small to bother, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, and same with the piranhas. The piranhas like, you're too small, I'm not going to eat you. You know, but anything big was din-din.
Yeah.
But, you know, I never I never saw, I caught colored up males, male epistogrammas, but I never saw a displaying male epistogramma in hundreds of hours underwater. I saw pairs of Wahroo. I saw lots of pairs of pike cichlids. Pike cichlids take care of their young for a long time. I saw pairs of pike from babies 2 inches long.
Wow.
You know, it wasn't a lot of fish, you know, as soon as the fry are free swimming and look like a fish instead of just a little speck, they're like, see you later, have a nice life.
Right.
And
yeah,
get
started up on the second batch, yeah.
Right, angelfish are like that. Angelfish have especially wild angelfish, have what I call a dispersal mechanism, where if you get a dozen baby wild angels and put them in like a 29-gallon tank, a dozen domestic angels would be fine, but you put a dozen wild ones in, they start chewing the crap out of each other. But you put them in 100, and they do okay, but they still fight. But then all of a sudden, when they get sexually mature, a switch turns, and they all group together. But they seem to want to disperse genetic similarity. They don't want to. They don't want their own kind together. You know, they want
so a regulation, like a way to regulate or prevent inbreeding.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly. Yep. Yep.
It drives.
In other fish, it seems like the males go away. The females will stay in one area, and the males will go wandering and looking for females. And that's how you get genetic diversity and variability. But one big problem that episcopals face as far as maintaining the same species genetics is that many of these creeks have barriers to population dispersal. You know, once you get into that environment, you really can't get out. You know, if you're adapted to soft acid water, and that soft acid water empties into a pH of 8.8, you see, then this happens a lot. You see, like where the Rio Negro empties into the Amazon, the waters don't mix, and it looks like coffee and cream. And the dolphins all know this. The pink dolphins and the gray dolphins all know this, and they hang out there waiting for fish that go from one water to the other and get disoriented. The dolphins don't care.
Oh, because of the pH shock?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, you see fish floating stunned from pH shock. And the dolphins just grab them right up. Silver dollars especially. Silver dollars swim from, they're normally in the alkaline water, and sometimes they'll get spooked and they'll go into the acid water and they'll just shock out, and the dolphins are right behind them, and they just gobble them up. Leporinus, the same thing. They'll shock out in acid water. But these small fish, so this is a barrier to dispersal. If you're shocking out, when you come from acid into alkaline, you shock out, you really can't get to that next acid water creek that's only 2 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you might during a heavy rainstorm, you know, when the pH is diluted and everything is just right, but it's not an everyday occurrence. So you end up with, we see this with Epistogrammus, with Corydoras, with Crenocichla. Every creek has got something a little bit different. You know, you look at the color pattern, those are Corydoras melanistus or Corydoras julii. But you look and they're not really Corydoras. Yeah, they are, but they're not really. They're not the ones that you normally see, because the ones you normally see come from the river that's 100 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and these just have evolved enough to be, I think, in some cases, we used to call them subspecies, but, you know, well, who knows what they call what they are now. Part of a species complex.
Right, but with some definite differences based on their, I guess you could say, hydrologic barriers, maybe?
Yes, exactly. I think that's a good way of putting it. The hydrologic barriers, except during extreme flood events, probably isolate and tend to concentrate the gene pools a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So that we found Epistogramma trifasciatus in a series of creeks, and they went from blue, a blue trifasciatus, to a reddish trifasciatus over a course of, I think it was seven creeks. And you can see...
Was it a gradual change?
Yeah, it was a gradual clinal difference. But it was definite. You know, the two from the two ends were totally different. But you really couldn't tell where it changed. And we saw that in a species in Central America. Robert Sonai is a very interesting cichlid. And it is very close to being an aurium in some areas. As a matter of fact, it was... We're not really sure where it changed. We found areas that we found Robertsoni in one area. This is in Belize, in Chiapas. We found definitely Robertsoni. We went downstream. We found Robertsoni that had different coloration, and then we found Robertsoni that had totally different coloration and a different head shape. And then we found something that really looked more like aurium, but had Robertsoni traits left to it. So we don't know what's going on in so many places. You know, we just haven't looked hard enough at enough data. And collecting is really, really difficult for a lot of these fish. Some people have no idea how difficult it is to just sample an area. We used to go out at night with headlamps and dive gear and you know, search. And I mean, that's how we came up with new species. I mean, you look around and you find, and there's new stuff everywhere. There's just so much territory to cover, so many barriers to catching stuff. There's so much flooded forest. It's extremely difficult to collect. You know, when you go into flooded forest, you find these small areas where you're fortunate to collect, but you may be collecting, a football field area out of an area the size of Rhode Island. You know, it's...
Overwhelming task.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and this football field area is divided up into areas the size of a kitchen. You know, little pockets of openness that you find and try to get into and search and it's you know, we caught a lot of fish in a lot of places using a lot of different techniques, but it's not simple and it's not for the faint of heart. I mean, one time they took a picture of me holding up a net at night, and when the picture was developed, there was a crocodile right behind me, 3 feet behind me, that the flash revealed.
Oh,
wow!
I'm in waist deep water, in the middle of the jungle.
Oh,
yeah.
that's a nightmare.
Toes are like squeezing around, going, "Ah, don't eat my feet!"
Yeah. Yep. It's you really can't think about all the things that can go wrong, because if you do, you won't go in the water.
Right.
You know, there's
that makes sense.
There's so many things down there. I mean, you see little kids, 2 years old, playing in dugout canoes all day long. The mothers could, you know, go ahead, go play, you know. And the kids swim like fish, so they're not going to drown. But as soon as it starts getting dark, the mothers come down and they gather up all the kids and they drag them up. You know, of course, the kids don't want to go. They want to keep playing.
Right.
And the ducks, which have been swimming around with the kids, also go up on the dry land. And it's really funny to watch the mothers drag the kids into the huts. But the ducks, they're kind of tame, but they're really not. So they don't want to go into the jungle because they know there's stuff in the jungle that's going to eat them. But there's no way they're staying too close to the edge of the river, because there are catfish 6 to 10 feet long there. I have seen and helped catch. Huge catfish that could easily eat a child. Easily. We once walked through the jaws in a village, through the jaws of a catfish that somebody had caught and opened the jaws of and made it into a doorway.
That's incredible.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were that big. It was huge. It was five feet spread on the jaws. It was unbelievable. And you know, not big teeth like a shark or anything, but, you know, if you get swallowed by one of these things, it's all over.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
People disappear down there all the time.
Okay, well, that's all we have time for right now, but we're going to continue next week with episode 172B, the continuation of the interview with Jim Carmack, Epistogrammas and Beyond. Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.